Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
The thing about being ahead of your time is that you've shown people behind you what to do.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 197, a talk with Martin Connor. Martin is the brains behind the website Rap Analysis and the author of the upcoming book, The Artistry of Rap Music. He's a trained composer and musician who looks at rapping from a perspective that should be common, but sadly is all too frequently missing from discussions around hip-hop. He looks at rapping as music. Martin's examinations of rappers' deliveries, phrasing, and styles are second to none and will have you listening to your favorite artists in a whole new way. We spoke to Martin Connor via Skype. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the only man who can compare Lil Wayne to Mozart and actually back it up, Martin Connor. People who listen may have seen an essay or two of yours or maybe heard your podcast or something, but for people who aren't familiar, can you kind of give me a little rundown of who you are and what you do?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I wanted to say thanks to both you guys for having me on the show. I've been watching your moves for a long time, so that's just the first order of business to take care of. So thanks a lot, guys.
Of course.
Yeah, so it just comes from, I am someone who looks at rap music as a phenomenon, as an event of simply pure music. You know, there are a lot of great people out there doing work on rap, from what you might call like a racial, societal, sociological standpoint, like Trisha Rose, who's at Brown, I think, or looking at rap as like a poetic phenomenon of poetry, rhymes, the poetic line, scansion, all of that, like Dr. Bradley.
Martin is referring to literary scholar Adam Bradley, who wrote Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip Hop.
And then, of course, someone like you doing such great work on like the historical aspect of it or the cultural aspect of rap. So where I come in is I kind of like to round out that view by then bringing in a musical viewpoint of it. So, you know, I try to stay away from talking about, like, you know, where Kanye's from, what the important years in hip hop were, and just look at it for rap as like just pure rhythm, you know, pure rhythm and pitch, which is the definition of melody. Because I think a lot of people, like I just said, have appreciated rappers as, you know, historians, comedians, poets, commentators on race relations in America, but I'm not sure that a whole lot of people even know that rappers are musicians in this sense too. So this draws me towards really who I would think of as musical rappers, because I think of someone as Kanye West as a funny rapper or a swag rapper.
Mr. West is in the building, swagger on 100,000 trillion.
And I might think of Tupac as someone like a good storyteller rapper or poetic rapper.
I hear Brenda's got a baby, but Brenda's barely got a brain. A damn shame, the girl can hardly spell her name. That's not our problem, that's up to Brenda's family. Well, let me show you how it affects our whole community. Now, Brenda really.
But then someone like Kendrick has just great music, great rhythms. People like MF Doom, Talib Kweli, Jean Grey, Lauryn Hill. These are kind of the complex rappers whose rhythms change so often.
Picking off you sucker, dick or die, you sucker, bunch of wall of bullets coming from AKs, ARs, AR, duck. That's what mama said when we was eating that free lunch.
Come on, fight. Looky here, it's just the way the cookie tear. Prepare to get hurt and mangle like Kurt Angle, rookie year.
We die hard like the battery, thrown in the back of me by the mad MC. Who think imitation's the highest form of flattery. Actually, don't be mad at me, I had to be the one to break it to you.
I define my place as home, neostasis. The chromio bass riffs and homie don't play this.
Let's rap orgies with Borgie and Bess. Capture your bounty like Elliot Ness. Yes, bless you.
You can really compare them to even like the most complex soloists. The Jimi Hendrix of The Voice is how I kind of think of Kendrick Lamar. And it's just come from my training, because my favorite music is rap, but I was trained in piano and guitar. So trying to fit those two together was how I've gotten to writing about what I write about now.
Okay. So when did those two things, the kind of listening to hip hop and getting into that, what were kind of the first steps for you in connecting that with the musical training you were getting in theory and composition and kind of the stuff you came across in a more traditional music education?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just funny because, you know, it was like a certain day and time, and I can almost pinpoint it exactly. It would have been my junior year at Duke, which was 2011, second spring semester. So it probably would have been towards the end, April. I want to say, I mean, yeah, day and time, like, I don't know, let's just say April 15th, like probably 11 in the morning, because that was the point at which I had my composition lesson with my teacher at Duke, you know, who taught me all of these traditional classical concepts of rhythm and jazz. And so, you know, to summarize, we looked together, me and my teacher, and he would teach me whoever, Mozart, Bach, Beethoven. And I remember it very specifically this day and time, because this was kind of when we had our disagreement over the nature of rap. So my teacher actually did not think that music or that rap was music at all, like straight up. And he has an article called A Melody? Word.
We'll link to the article in the show notes at thecyphershow.com.
And it was written in the Chronicle, the Duke student daily newspaper. So when I came in that day, he had seen an article actually that I wrote arguing that rap is music. And it just so happened that he released his own article in the student newspaper that day. So we disagreed because he thinks that rap does not paint, he's a black man. He doesn't think that rap paints black people in a flattering light. So he objects to it for these reasons and then is led to dismiss it all his music altogether because of that. And so I had just struggled with this for a long time because it was almost like an identity crisis. I thought that I was not a good musician because when I went home, I didn't listen to classical music. I mean, that's the long and short of it. You know, I love classical music. I like to listen to Debussy, Mozart, Bach, all the big ones. But I oftentimes appreciate it more from an intellectual than an emotional standpoint, classical music. So if I'm ever listening to music for fun, for leisure, to hang out with my friends or whatever, it's always going to be rap. So from trying to kind of solve this identity crisis, which came down to, okay, I'm classically trained, but I love this popular kind of music, rap, that is how I got to combining those two things. The classical training of knowing how to notate music, knowing how to play instruments, being able to sight sing, being able to transcribe rhythms on hearing it, and then applying it to my popular music because I was almost like a scientist. You know, I had this hypothesis that rappers might actually be expert musicians, and that was the reason for why I could be classically trained but still love rappers. So as I dug deeper and deeper into it, you know, I had the Kendrick article, How to Listen to Backseat Freestyle.
Martin had a dream. Martin had a dream.
In this article, not only does Martin set out to define the ways you can musically describe flow, but he actually sets the lyrics to Kendrick's Backseat Freestyle to sheet music. You haven't lived until you've seen the phrase pussy to motherfucking expressed in 16th and 32nd notes. Of course, we'll link to the entire article in our show notes.
Then I just started finding more and more proof than I ever thought I could. And then that was kind of the definitive proof I could point to kind of, yeah, just get over that hump of, okay, I'm classically trained, and when I go into a classroom, they always talk about Mozart or Bach, but when I go home, I put on Tupac, Kendrick, Wu-Tang, got the whole Dr. Dre discography. So yeah, that's really where it came from.
Okay. So you started, as you mentioned, writing articles, and then you had your blog,
yeah,
which initially was called Composer's Corner.
Yes.
What was the idea behind starting that?
Yeah, that's really just one of those things, man. I wish I knew. I kind of wish I could tell you. I don't know if I was bored junior year and I was like, shit, I need something to do with my time. But like, I just started a blog and I just started writing on it. And what led me, the idea behind it was, yeah, just to get it out there. You know, I'm always looking to exchange ideas and share ideas, which is why I'm so happy to be on this podcast. But just to really engage in like the exchange of ideas, like I think rappers are musicians. I would love to hear why someone doesn't think they're musicians. And so that's why I love Dr. Kelly's article, even if I'm not entirely sure it was written in good faith, like actually giving rappers a chance to be good musicians. So yeah, and so I started out, I thought I could help people, really, I guess is why I started it. And so it began as a way for me to explain what I loved about classical music in a way that anyone could understand. Then, after looking at looking around a little bit, I realized that lots of people were doing that, so I didn't want to do it anymore, like Alex Ross of The New Yorker. And then I started talking about rap itself, but I kind of focused on the text, because that's the most easiest thing to access. You know, there are lyrics, you obviously memorize the lyrics and all that. But then I kind of realized that Dr. Bradley, to a large extent, had said everything that needed to be said, and so then I didn't want to talk about that anymore. So after those two things kind of had it worked out, I was like, I combined that with sort of the identity crisis I was going through as a musician, and I was just like, well, what if I talked about it as pure music? And just it's notable because at every point at which I think rap could not possibly teach me about an element of music, it does. I thought rhythm would be the limit, and then MF Doom moved me past rhythm to harmony, which is pitches and chords.
Swift with the 9 through a 5950. Well educated, he heard it when he meditated in deep theta. Let her hate the creep played up.
Martin points out in his upcoming book that on Doom's song Vomit Spit, he, quote, raps a majority of his notes on just one note in the song's musical scale, the F note. MF Doom's music turns out to be artistically original when it's set against all the rest of popular music. This is because, while MF Doom delivers his melody with the pitch system of true singing, almost everything else about it couldn't be more rap.
You know, I thought rhythm was the limit, and then melody got brought into it. So yeah, that was probably the start of the blog, though.
Okay, so now you have a book coming out, which is great. I got a chance to take a sneak peek at it. In the beginning of the book, you know, you write that when people talk about musical geniuses, about great musicians, they'll mention Mozart or the Beatles, or, you know, in some cases, even John Coltrane or Miles Davis. Uh-huh. But rappers never come up in the popular imagination when you think of musical geniuses. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of give me a short capsule answer as to maybe why that is?
Yeah, I think it's a multifaceted problem, and some of the problems you might even be able to guess. I mean, for the first thing, rappers don't go to school, right, to be able to learn their craft. There is no rap school. There aren't even any rap teachers. I've read about an ad hoc system where I forget who taught Pharoah Monch, or maybe someone taught one of the Run DMC MCs, like Daryl taught Rev Run or something like that. But yeah, there's just no school. So I don't know. In a certain way, it's logical. Well, if you never went to school for this thing, then how could there ever possibly be masters at it? Another thing, I think it is a little bit racist and classist that you just would not expect humans from such the lower socioeconomic classes to people who have been to jail. Tupac was a felon convicted of, I think, first degree assault.
I'm living in hell, stuck in my jail cell, stranded in the county jail, waiting for my Tesla post bail.
Tupac was convicted in 1994 of first-degree sexual abuse dating from a November 93 incident. He was sentenced to 1.5 to 4.5 years in prison, but ended up serving 9 months.
So yeah, it's just like this mismatch between you imagine a man like Tupac, and then you think of certain people in the establishment look at Tupac, and then they compare him to the commonly accepted visualization of musical genius. Like, you know, Tupac doesn't look like Jimi Hendrix, he doesn't look like Mozart, he doesn't look like Beethoven, he doesn't even necessarily look like Miles Davis or anything like that. You know, you always see him with his signature bandana and tattoos. So I think it comes from that just rappers just don't look like musical geniuses as this kind of stereotype of the musical genius has been built up. So I think that's part of it. And another part of it is just their music is really radical. Like, I would call it radically innovative, because how could you possibly talk about their words as music if their music doesn't follow a scale? You know, almost all music is based on the idea of a scale, which is an octave divided into 8 different parts. So it's basically the notes from C to C. You go C, D, E, F, G, A, B, and then you're back at C. And this is where almost all Western music comes from. It's where you get your chords from, your harmonies, your keys, the start and end of pieces, your structure. But rappers don't necessarily always engage with any or even most of that. So it just becomes like, well, if it's really hard for us to talk about them in the form of musical geniuses, then I answer it by saying, well, we have to find better tools, but other people might answer it by saying, well, they're just not geniuses in the first place. I think those three big things are probably the biggest reasons for why people might be resistant to the idea of rappers as musicians.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, you know, you mentioned that there's sort of no formal education mm-hmm. system towards becoming a rapper. And we've seen that, we've begun to see the first tentative steps towards that with DJing.
Yeah, yeah.
With places like Scratch Academy. I know that, you know, Berklee has a turntable class.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
Yeah. Rob Swift, one of our guests, has, you know, started teaching turntablism himself. Do you think that some kind of organized education system like that with regard to rapping is even necessary? Can you see any drawbacks for it? Do you see steps towards it happening currently?
Necessary is a strong word. I want to see it. And I know it's possible. Let's just start there, because I've established it in my own right with people who reach out to me through my website. So I've taught about maybe like 50 or 60 lessons to 20 different students who pay me to do hour-long lessons where, yeah, I mean, we just sit down with it, you know? This is kind of my whole philosophy, because it, at a certain point, it does go beyond music, because I use music to learn about the world, whatever it is. It's just like, this is what I mean. Rap is not different. Like, rap is not fundamentally different. It just looks different. But the essence of it as music, I mean, that can always be taught. You can always teach anything. So yeah, I mean, so if you were to see one of the lessons that I teach to people at rap, it looks very similar to a traditional music lesson. You go one of two ways. They come, they show me some of their music. I give them feedback based on what I've done and also based on what the masters have done. The masters in this case being Tupac, Notorious B.I.G., Lauryn Hill, Gene Gray, whoever you want to say. And then the other part of it is then I give them feedback on their music, and then you look directly at the music of the master. So I have these transcriptions, you know, just like when I go to my composition lessons and Dr. Benjamin C.S. Boyle of Temple University shows me a Richard Schumann piano song, and so I can learn the harmony. Well, then, yeah, we just go look at like the text, so I can show how Lauryn Hill takes these really everyday cliches like nothing even matters, but then by singing it in the most beautiful way possible, reinvents the cliche into something just so universal.
The world seems so very small, 'cause nothing even matters at all. See, nothing even matters. See, nothing even matters at all. Nothing even matters.
That the album on which that song appears goes on to win 5 Grammys, you know? I think it would be a supplement. That's why I shy away from the word necessary, because I've been criticized by people who just say, oh, to teach rap isn't hip-hop culture, which I don't know what that means, to be frank. But, like, it's going to supplement, you know, because there is always this element of you doing it on your own, but then you learning from other people. But important part of this is that rap has developed the way it has because there is no informal schooling system. Like, part of its strength is the fact that there is no informal schooling system, because then there's never an opportunity for the genre to ossify into really standard flows or, sorry, I hate using that word, really standard melodies or really standard songs, you know? I think if you look at the genre today, there's just such a wealth of variety and uniqueness from one rapper to the next. Not just that they're all original, but they're all original in their one way. Like, how different is Chance from Kanye to Young Thug to Kendrick?
Ooh, after them, you can't touch me. Nah, 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 nah. I got angels. I got angels. I ain't changed my number since the 7th grade.
All the girls that got dick from Kanye West. If you see him in the streets, give him Kanye's best. Why? They mad they ain't famous.
Goddamn.
They mad they still nameless.
Talk that talk, man.
I'm man, but it's too bitch. Can't hide a motherfucker. Even if she the baddest, the motherfucker. Man, even if she minus the motherfucker. Join in, get demolished, motherfucker.
True friends, one question. Bitch, where you and I was walking? Now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off him. Kunta, black man taking no losses.
Oh, yeah.
Bitch, where you and I was walking? Now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut.
And they're all great in their own way. And I think a big part of that is because there is no kind of school that could ever proliferate its own dominant ideas of what rap should be. So necessary, I definitely want to see it, but to say it's necessary sounds strong to me.
Right. You just said the word flow, and then you said, I don't really like that word. Flow is kind of a weird catch-all word in hip-hop that, as I understand it, has something to do with rhythmic choices and phrasing, and has something to do with, you know, delivery and the feel of where words are placed in relation to the beat, and has something to do with the person's voice. How do you understand flow the way that it's used, and why don't you like it?
I would love to explain how I understand it, but I don't understand it, so I don't use it, you know? It's just like, it's kind of like there's nothing to understand, man. Like, it's an empty word. You could go to 10 different conversations and hear the word flow used by 10 different people, and it's just anything useful in the concept of flow, we already have a word for as musicians, and that's melody. Just call it melody, because then we know what you're talking about. And just the concept of flow, it kind of seems like a backhand compliment to rappers. Like, oh, rappers could never have melody, but they have something, so let's just call it flow, you know, as almost like melody's next best thing, or like its little cousin, that you don't want to dismiss rappers completely, but there's absolutely no way that rappers could ever do something like develop a theme over the course of 16 bars, even though that's exactly what Game does on the song How We Do, or Kendrick on Rigor Mortis.
Fresh like, Impala, chrome hydraulics, 808 drums, you don't want none, nigga better run, when beef is on, I pop that trunk.
And this is Rigor Mortis, and it's gorgeous when you die, Ali recorded, and I'm Morpheus, the matrix in my mind, I'm out the orbit, you an orphan, and a hairdresser combined, I'm on the toilet when I rhyme, if you the shit, then I decline, I climax with you.
So I think when people use the word flow, it's kind of more like a signifier. Basically, if I were to help the word flow out as much as possible, I would say that flow refers to everything in rap that is nonverbal. So you almost have to define it as a negative, right? Nonverbal, non-poetic, non-textual. So you're not talking about the words. But at that point, you know, again, it just becomes really problematic because flow means lots of different things to lots of different people. And I'm even working on, because the first article I know of that was accepted into a scholarly journal by Dr. Kyle Adams of Indiana University was called On Metrical Techniques of Flow in Rap Music.
Kyle Adams' article was published in Music Theory Online, a journal for the Society of Music Theory, in October 2009. He writes, quote, "This article explores the concept of flow in rap, a term which I use to encompass all of the ways in which a rapper uses rhythm and articulation in his or her lyrical delivery." We'll link to the article in the show notes.
So he used it. But I think we really have to pull it apart and just realize that it's used in so many ways that it doesn't have explanatory power. Like, I saw this YouTube video yesterday that called flow a drum pattern over an instrumental beat. But like, that seems to really sideline the pitch of rappers, which is obviously so important in giving structure to their verses. So I would really love to see people stop using the word flow, because we already have melody, and what's best in flow is already in the word melody. So like, if you're gonna, and then it just makes the whole system for studying rap a lot cleaner to me, because you can talk about it as melody, poetry, a cultural phenomenon, a style, a historical genre as having a history to it. So yeah, honestly, like, that's the best I can do with flow. I just think it's too, almost like insulting to rappers to use the word once you really get to the heart of what flow is. It just becomes really confusing.
Right. And there's an example you use in your book. You have a chapter about Pharoah Monch.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the intro on his debut solo album. Listening back to that track, it reads to me, and I think to most people, as, and you mentioned this in the book, as spoken word.
Yeah.
Right?
May I have your attention, please? What you are about to hear is undoubtedly the most incredible MC of the year. No, wait, listen. All that I wish to do is to display a brand new vintage in the style that I have.
It's not rap, it's spoken word. It's sort of meant to call back to Last Poets, Gil Scott-Heron,
exactly.
You know, whomever. Why is some kind of talking over a beat read as spoken word poetry, but other kinds of talking over a beat by the same person with literally the same voice read as rap? What's the key difference?
Yeah, that's actually a great insight and a great question, because it comes down to how much the rhythmic accents of their voice are responding to the repeating instrumental accompaniment behind them. So what I love about this is that it's really actually, you know, I may have used some words that people think that they don't know what they mean, but in actuality, all music is so logical that it's real easy to give an explanation of, right? So when you have this instrumental accompaniment, and yeah, that's a great one, so let's just work with Gil Scott-Heron, comment number one, because that's what Kanye West pulls for his final My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy track, Who Will Survive in America?
In the name of Piggy Wallace, Dickless Nixon, and Spyro Agnew, leave Brother Cleaver and Brother Malcolm alone, please. After all is said and done, build a new route to China if they'll have you. Who will survive in America? Who will survive in America? Who will survive in America? Who will survive in America?
So he pulled a sample from Gil Scott-Heron's comment number one. And let's compare it to Pharaoh Monch's intro. So they both have these instrumental accompaniments based on what is known in music as meter. And meter is just an organization of a pulse, you know? The only difference between musical sounds and non-musical sounds is that musical sounds are organized in strict mathematical relationships according to time. So if you have a beat like this, like I'm snapping, that's music. But if you listen to me just talking right now, my voice isn't organized like that. It isn't organized into these really repeating strong accents. But then all of a sudden, if I talk like this, then it becomes music, you know? So that's the difference. And the difference is that Gil Scott-Heron preserves the freedom of his rhythms of his voice on a song like Comment Number One, or when Kanye West borrows it for Who Will Survive in America. And Pharaoh Monch on a a song besides intro, let's say Body Baby, he does fit his voice to that repeating pulse.
New fisco, yeah, with a new twist so that y'all can get it just to the rhyme I do not miss. I will not fail. Please take a glimpse in the time at your own risk. I will not fail.
So the difference is that a rapper rapping to, let's just call it a quote-unquote normal beat, their strong accents, the syllables that they accent, line up with the beat behind them. So just take the most famous line in rap. Well, to me, it should be the most famous line, I guess, if it's not. I never sleep, because sleep is the cousin of death.
I never sleep, because sleep is the cousin of death.
One of the accents is on the word cousin, and that accent is on the first syllable, cousin. You don't say cousin. If you were, you would sound like you were speaking French or something like that, whose own accents do fall on the last syllable. And it's interesting because French rappers, when they do rap in French, actually have to break the own rules of their own language, because French has a lot more standard accenting according to linguistic phonology than English does. But so Nas lines up the accents of his syllables with the accents of the music, and that makes it this more standard form of rapping. But Pharaoh Monch on intro, or Gil Scott-Heron, does not do that, and that's why it sounds so free, you know? An example of this is Hypnotize, when P. Diddy is doing the hype man, like, oh yeah, or whatever, behind Biggie, which does get a little annoying at points. But he does it so freely that it comes across more as talking.
Close like Starsky and Hutch, stick to clutch. Yeah, I squeeze three at your cherry M3. Bang every MC easily.
Take that.
Easily. Huh? Recently, niggas frontin' ain't saying nothing, so I just speak my piece, keep my peace. Cubans with the...
So really, it just matters how much you line up, basically, how much you line up the accents of your syllables with the accents of music. And you can go back and forth between them, which is what Kanye does on one of the later The Life of Pablo tracks, when he's talking about, what if we fucked at this Vogue party? You can tell at one point he actually very slightly lapses into normal speaking rhythms.
What if we fucked right now? What if we fucked right in the middle of this motherfucking dinner table? What if we fucked at this Vogue party? Will we be the life of the whole party? Shut down the whole party? Will everybody stop fucking? Will everybody stop fucking?
But yeah, I mean, and that right there is the difference between music and non-music, as seen in Pharaoh Monch's intro and comment number one by Gil Scott.
You know, you mentioned the Diddy ad-lib track, which brings to mind another song you focus on in the book, which is Busta Rhymes' Don't Get Carried Away, which has this second vocal track of him doing ad-libs at different times, you know, just different sounds, different kind of one-syllable noises at various parts in the track that are kind of a mixture of, they sort of happen at predictable times, but they don't exactly repeat.
And a lot of shit I'm seeing while I sip on Moretto. A lot of bitches on the strip strutting in their stilettos. Then they wave and say hello while my Lambo is yellow. Everything they got a jingle when they walk like a jello. See the niggas on the...
Why is that song important enough that you decided to focus on it in the book? What is notable about it?
Right now, if one thing happens from this interview, what I would love for it to be is a complete rewriting of Busta Rhymes' place in rap history. Because I know people know him as Long in the Game, an OG, did his thing on Scenario, Tribe Called Quest. But this man deserves to be in any conversation of the greatest rappers of all time, you know? I would also love to throw Lauryn Hill in there. So you should maybe bring up Tupac, then Biggie, then Lauryn Hill, but then like Busta Rhymes. Because what Busta does on this track, he just shows that he understands music. And that's what that whole chapter is about. He realizes that music, whether it's classical music, blues music, rock music, whatever, psychedelic, rock, jazz, folk, country, whatever, it's just these relationships that the musician chooses to mediate. And these relationships occur on every piece of music, no matter what it is. It's between repetition and variation. It's between a main subject and its details. It's between innovation and conservatism. Whatever you want to say. So what he does on this, he shows that he understands music because it's exactly like what you said. He always throws in these monosyllables. You could call them vocables, like scatting in jazz almost. But he throws them in at unpredictable points. But when they show... it's a paradox. It's why I goddamn love music. Because it's so... It just shows you... You can learn about the universe from it, I guess. Because it shows you, like, he shows up at unpredictable points, but, like, his consistency is inconsistent. Or his inconsistency is consistent. So what he's done on this track, and it really this deserves to be a better known track, is yes, he has that normal speaking voice going on, like you hear on any rap track, the flow that's right, the melody that's right in your ear, right up front that you hear. But yeah, like you said, behind him, he throws in these like, huh! Or like, ah! And stuff like that over and over. And what I love about it is he's just reduced rap to its purely musical elements to the point where, and I have an article forthcoming on this it says the reason why people love Scenario, because it's just pure music. I'm not saying that the words he's writing don't matter on the track, but you really need to listen to how he's saying the words that he's saying and not necessarily the semantic content of the way he's saying his words. At that point, it's almost like symbolist poetry, the French school of the 1800s, when they would take a word, let's take one of my favorite words, like mellifluous. You know, like, yeah, mellifluous has a definition to it, which is honey sounding or nice sounding, smoothly flowing. But if you just say the word like mellifluous, mellifluous, mellifluous over and over, it starts to undermine that semantic meaning. And then you just appreciate it as a pure sonic object, which is why I think people love Scenario so much, even though most people haven't talked about it. I mean, think about Scenario. How many times, what is he saying on Scenario that deserves for that track to be so famous? You know, he repeats himself over and over. An entire two bars is dedicated to him just saying the word over and over.
All over the track, man. Pardon me, as I come back.
All over the track, man. You know, so it comes down to that. He's able to repeat himself because he's not really worried about those repetitions. He's worried about the effect of those repetitions on your ear. And you can hear it. Boom. I mean, he imitates a goddamn dungeon dragon.
Like a dungeon dragon.
And he's free enough.
Whatever that is, by the way, which is a great whole different, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it wasn't. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. A dungeon dragon is not a goddamn thing, man. So it's like he didn't care. He just wanted. He wanted you to feel his rap. He did not want you to understand his rap. And Jesus, isn't that like the guiding aesthetic of so many rappers today? You know, it's Young Thug. It's Nigeria before 15 years before. No, I guess 25 years. 23 before Young Thug's Nigeria came out, you know? That's why I love Young Thug.
I got key, no dizzy. Young Thug is frigid. My flow is hot like a motherfucker skid. When I look at myself, look like a meal ticket.
But it's all those guys, Kendrick Lamar, Young Thug. I mean, Chance the Rapper on Ultralight Beam, he just throws in like a gospel track at one point. This little light of mine.
Make it so free and the bar so hard that it ain't one gosh darn part. You can't tweet. This is my part, nobody else speak. This is my part, nobody else speak. This little light of mine. Glory be to God, yeah. I'ma make sure.
And then he just starts singing. And I think a lot of this is up to Busta Rhymes. And that's why you hear Q-Tip introduce him almost like an instrument.
We'll never waste no time on a played out ego. So here's Busta Rhymes with the Scenario.
Watch as I combine all the juice from the mind.
Like almost like in the same way an orchestra prepares the entrance of a solo instrument. And then he goes on, yeah, it's the onomatopoeia. Rawr, rawr, but he doesn't care. He doesn't care that rawr does not have any semantic meaning, you know? He just wanted you to hear the effect of it. And that's, I mean, that's like Busta Rhymes. And yeah, all over. Break Your Neck, Holla, Don't Get Carried Away. He just, for me, so much, he changed how I understand rap. And you even see it in Waka Flocka, man. Because from what I've been talking about, you know, classically trained, I love WC, whatever you want to say. You might think I hate Waka Flocka. I goddamn love Flockavelli, man. That whole album is just nuts to me. Because Waka Flocka, it's like the same kind of thing that Busta said. But it doesn't matter what he's saying. Because, dude, that guy doesn't say anything. But it's the way he says it. And it's why I love the song Karma. What other ones are on there? Grove Street Party, all of those. They're just great tracks.
I rock so many niggas. Karma came right back around.
My dresses start a riot. The girls get excited. All don't wanna try it. I'm like, why not try it? My sway, they wanna.
So these are the artists I love to talk about, and I think a lot of it, to a great degree, started with Busta Rhymes. Because, yeah, I mean, when, who do you want to say, Afrika Bambaataa, Rapper's Delight, Sugar Hill Gang got together, of course rap was music back then, but they didn't emphasize its musical aspects. And I would say Tupac didn't do that either. You know, Tupac is much more concerned about the story, and Jesus, if I were to make a list of the top 10 storytelling songs of rap in all time, Tupac would have 5, Kanye would have 3, and then, like, 2 spaces left for everyone else. I mean, it's Brenda's Got a Baby, Changes, even the outro ad-libs of Hit 'Em Up. It might not seem like he's telling a story, but if you think of that as being a story of how Tupac feels towards people who have wronged him, it becomes as scary as, like, I don't know, man, The Shining or some shit like that.
Now when I came out, I told you it was just about Biggie. Then everybody had to open their mouth with a motherfucker opinion. Well, this is how we gonna do this. Fuck Mobb Deep. As a staff, record label, and as a motherfucking crew. And if you wanna be down with Bad Boy, then fuck you too. Chino XL, fuck you too. All you motherfuckers.
That's that though. That's a great question though.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about Andre 3000 in the book.
Uh-huh.
And it brings up this issue. You talk about the ways in his rhythms and a through line you see from kind of bebop phrasing to him. And one of the things that comes up there is this idea that at least on some songs, he's rapping behind the beat in a way that a jazz player might play behind the beat.
Yeah.
And you sort of hint at this idea that it has something to do with the South in the book. And I think you can see that with some of the Houston rappers, people like Bun and Pimp and Zero, and people who also have that kind of behind the beat feel, you know. And in fact, some of the music from Houston is literally slowed down. There's sort of subgenre of stuff that is actually normal music, but slowed down. Can you talk about this idea of behind the beat and maybe its relationship to the South as you understand it?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me just, take the first part first and explain what behind the beat would be. So again, it kind of does come down to this dichotomy. I don't think it's a oppositional one, or like the forces are in conflict, but they just work together by being separate. Like this dichotomy between Western, I'm going to gloss as non-Western music. So you have in Western music, this kind of whole concept of playing behind the beat did not exist before our modern musical period, you know? So if this is like the beat, then if I were to play something in a second, I'm always going to be on the beat. So I'm just going to use my voice. I would play right here like, duh, 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 duh. And you can kind of hear that I'm right on the beat. But when you get this tradition of drumming from Western Africa, to the same extent, I think, you might say Europeans developed harmony into our complex things of tonality or whatever. That's how much they developed drumming and rhythm, which is why, like, again, music is always a mediating relationship among competing aspects of a sonic texture. So what are you going to do when you make a song? Are you going to focus on the rhythm? Are you going to focus on the harmony? Are you going to focus on the melody? And you can't do all of it because it'll just come across as unorganized noise. So these drummers concentrated on rhythm, and what they eventually developed was this thing that I've heard referred to as trailing in the 2014 movie Whiplash.
Count again.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Rushing
four.
Or dragging?
Rushing.
So you do know the difference.
So if I were to do that same example, this is the beat, then such drummers who eventually came down to us in the form of rappers would be slightly behind the beat, like this. Like, duh, 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 duh. But this delay is so small that it basically has no way to be expressed in Western music. So that's why they call it expressive micro-timing. It's the delay behind the beat is all expressive. You're still in time with the beat, but it's almost as if you've paradoxically, again, moved where the beat is. And I think a great example of this is the end of Look Out for Detox by Kendrick, because he is so far behind the beat, it's almost like he's breaking the beat in half.
Rap here, not a rapper. I'm a raptor. That's a T-Rex and a V-neck for the rapture. I'm a vector. Hey, you're facial, I will fracture to a fraction of one half, and I hate math and pastors like Eddie Long, fucking Mighty Gold, take me Mighty Long to get here.
I don't know how he managed to stay in time, because every instrumentalist, no matter what their instrument is, does it by finding the beat and then staying in time. But he's so far behind the beat that it's almost like he breaks it. So this is what we've come down to, and what was the second part of your question? Oh, Andre 3000, right?
Oh, just about its relationship to the U.S.
Yeah,
South,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, and so this is where we're on, from my point of view at least, a little more unfirm territory. Because, you know, it's a really great question, but it just, by the very nature of the question, it means that you need, it's very interdisciplinary research. Like, you need a whole bunch of people finding a whole lot of proof to assert something like this. Because it basically comes down to what extent, this is the real question, right? To what extent does music actually reflect the realities of the community from which it comes? And when I say music, I don't mean the text, the verbal poetry or anything. I mean the actual sounds themselves, you know? So, yeah, I would, and I should say, you know, I'm not a linguist, I'm not an anthropologist, I don't study the South, but from my point of view, there does, you know, what would you say? There's kind of the stereotype makes it sound negative, but I don't think it all is. But like the Southern drawl, right? From my qualitative experience and evidence, I would say that Southerners speak more slowly than Northerners. Do I think that means they're stupid? Absolutely not. It's just kind of the pattern of how their linguistics has grown up. The phonology or morphology, I'm not sure what linguistics would call it. But yeah, so if they speak slower, then maybe the fact that their rappers do seem to rap behind the beat to a greater extent is reflected by just the way Southerners talk, you know? And there is a great, it's tough to draw, maybe this is more, I would say it's more correlation than causation, because there are a lot of New York rappers who rap way behind the beat. I mean, Jay-Z comes to mind, Talib Kweli is one of my go-to examples for this. But then you get, like you said, you get to rappers like Andre 3000, who is way behind the beat to a greater extent than most people.
Twice upon a time, there was a boy who died and lived happily ever after. But that's another chapter. Live from home of the brave with dirty dollars, beauty parlors, baby ballers, bowling ball and parlors.
I mean, you can even compare it to Aquemini, right? Like, here I am saying that Southerners speak more slowly, but what is Big Boy kind of known for but his almost Midwest chopper style? And just, I mean, Aquemini, that first verse, now it's time to get on like Spike Lee said, get on the bus.
Now it's the time to get on like Spike Lee said, get on the bus. Go get your work and keep your beeper chirping, it's a must. Get you on that dust, cornstarch, familiar with that smack, man. The music is like that green stuff provided to you by Sack Man, Pac-Man.
I try to imitate that Big Boy flow from the opening of that song, and I just can't do it. My mouth will physically not move in those motions. But maybe someone growing up in the South is more used to pronouncing it in these different ways. So yeah, like you absolutely said, you know, you refer to indirectly to like chopped and screwed genres, the whole slower kind of thing, Paul Wall doing his thing. So I would love to see a study that would kind of compare. And there have been, actually, I saw a linguistic study of Eminem's, actually it was in the book that led to my current deal of the book that you're checking out now, in Eminem and Rap Poetry Race, but it compared Eminem's diction, his phonology, I guess, whether he drops the G when he's using linking verbs like waiting or thinking or whatever.
You get the message, am I getting through to you? You know what's coming, you motherfuckers don't even know, do you?
It compares it to his community that he grew up in, Detroit, and sees where's that from? Because also he's from Missouri, you know, born in Missouri, I guess, but grew up in Detroit. So yeah, I would love to know. I don't know if it's connected to Southerners. Qualitative evidence tells me yes, but it would definitely be really interesting to tease out in a more in-depth way.
And talking about M, you know, you mentioned him in the book, and one thing you focus on in his style is articulation, which is to say, when he's rapping, and especially when he's rapping fast, it is still easy to understand what he's saying. Why is that? What are things that he does to make sure that even when he's rapping, say, as fast as he does in Rap God for as long, you can still get what he's saying.
Hip-hop, you don't really want to get into a piss and match with this rapity rat pack and a Mac in the back of the yak backpack, rap, rap, yap, 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 kitty yak, nap the exact same time I attempt these lyrical acrobat stunts while I'm practicing, that'll still be...
Yeah, I mean, it just comes from practice. Like, I think from knowing what I know from rapping on my own and writing rap and teaching rap, it just seems like he articulates his words in a really special, unique way. From what I can tell about my mouth when I try to imitate his rhythms on stuff like Eminem and Rap God, he actually pronounces his words really far forward in his mouth. Most words are pronounced by your tongue touching different parts of your mouth. And again, I would need a real linguist to check this out. But if you move those points of contact with your tongue farther forward in your mouth, I think the sound gets out past your lips more intact. Like, your lips physically do not interfere with the sound waves coming out from your voice box. And then that is why you're able to tell what he is saying so well. Because, yeah, that's what I miss about Rap God. It is the only article I have ever not only unpublished but been ashamed of in my life. When that song came out, I panned it. I thought it was terrible. I thought everyone just lost their minds over it because he was rapping so fast. And meanwhile, I was over here like a hipster jackass, like, oh, yeah, well, people have been rapping really fast for a long time. You know what? Tech N9ne, going back to Busta Rhymes on Break Your Neck. You really try to put it on the God. Doing it like I never did before for me. The way you break your back and I break your neck. And the way you try to put it on the floor for me. Come on. But he just did it so fast and so good for so long that only hit me when I sat down and listened to the song over and over and over. And he's able to articulate his words in a whole bunch of different ways. I mean, physically articulate them, like where he says his tongue. So, like, Eminem probably has like 30 different ways in which he can say the word gray. Almost like, you know, a percussionist, people make fun of the triangle player in an orchestra. Like, oh, how hard could it be to play a triangle? You know, the little thing you dink on and it makes that bell sound. There are so many ways to play the triangle. That is what that mofo is getting paid for, because you got to say it in the right way. So this is analogous to what Eminem's doing. Like, he has 20 different ways to say the word gray, and he's got to pick the right one for Rap God or whatever. And he's able to do it because, I swear to God, he thinks in rap. He has to. Like, when he has his inner dialogue, his inner monologue with himself, thinking about, like, oh, what do I want to eat today? I bet he raps it to himself. No one, I'm willing to make the bet that no one has ever rapped more than Eminem has rapped in his life, just in pure man hours. Doesn't matter how old you are, how much of a head start pioneers like Rakim might have on him, but he's just done it forever, and he got better on Marshall Mathers LP2. Are you kidding me? He made a goddamn country rap music song on that album, and it was not terrible.
Kiss my country bunkin' ass, Missouri Southern roots, what the fuck is upper class? Call lunch, dinner, call dinner, supper, Tupperware, in the cupboard, plastic, wear up the ass, stuck in the past. iPod, what the fuck is that? B-boy to the core, mule, I'm a stubborn ass. Maybe that's why.
That is like the greatest testament to his abilities ever. It wasn't bad. It's not my favorite song. It's a pretty good song, but like, I mean, just all over it. He got better, and I just did not think that was possible. I don't know if anyone has ever been better at anything than Eminem is at rap. Because you just listen to him. If he was not alive in a time period in which rapping had been created, modern America, 21st century, I don't think he would have made it through all the problems that he would have had with his wife, drugs, whatever you want to say. Like, rapping to a strong extent kept him alive, I feel like. And just when you hear that hunger on the mic, that's why I love him. And that's why, to me, I think he's probably the greatest rapper of all time. But I guess that's a discussion for another time.
Mm-hmm. You know, in one of your essays, you mentioned something that I think might be a little bit of a surprise to hip hop heads, one of your opinions, which is you say that rappers in sort of the aggregate have gotten better with time, that the innovations of someone like a Rakim or a G-Rap, you feel have actually been kind of taken in and advanced by the people who came after them. Can you kind of go into that a little bit? And have you ever gotten any pushback for saying stuff like that?
I have not gotten strong pushback, but I expect after this episode comes out, I definitely will. But this gets into my whole theory of art. It's almost a theory of aesthetics, you know? So the argument isn't about rap anymore. It's about what art is. And I'm sorry, I love Rakim, but the problem with being ahead of your time is that people catch up, is that you show other people what to do, and then if you don't keep doing it, you get overhauled, man. It's like Rakim was the Microsoft of rap. Like, yeah, Microsoft, whatever you want to say, invented computers, made personal computers affordable. But then Microsoft didn't fit themselves well into an era of mobile phones. So now we don't talk about Microsoft anymore. We talk about Apple, because Apple saw what Microsoft did, learned it, improved upon it, and then sold it. And so here we are. So I really think if you're going to take a objective stance, and I do, on artistic taste, I think artistic taste is much more objective than people are willing to grant. Even if you're not, though, I think I could still make an argument for why. I mean, yes, I love, what is it, Paid in Full. I love all those tracks. And you can still see that it has its influence. I mean, what, the Cool Kids, Gone Fishing mixtape, they directly reference so many Rakim beats.
Trying to be the man back then, reciting classic records like Eric B and Rakim. Knew the words to Paid in Full like the back of my hand.
Like, I nominate my DJ for president and I'm flossing.
I hold a conversation because what I invent, I nominated my DJ the president.
Yes, I nominate these two DJs for president and I'm flossing.
This is in no way to take away from what he has done. But, like, I'm sorry, if you put him in a room and asked for a rap battle against, any of those 10 people who are my chapters, Talib Kweli, MF Doom, Eminem, Pharrell Monch, Lil Wayne, Busta Rhymes, Andre 3000, Kendrick Lamar, maybe not Game, because Game is a specific instance of that. Dude, in a straight up battle, when these newer guys have as many tools as they've discovered, like Talib Kweli's complex polyrhythms, Busta Rhymes's polyphony, Kendrick Lamar's crazy song structures on Rigor Mortis, Backseat Freestyle, I don't see a situation in which Rakim wins that battle rap, you know? Besides reverence for forebears or pioneers or legends or whoever you want to say, it's just like, yes, Rakim was amazing for his time, but I would love to hear, because apparently I've seen the tweets and I think a tour is planned. I don't know about an album. I haven't heard anything, but like, I would love to know what he's rapping like today, because honestly, if he hasn't, you know, he didn't release too much stuff and he was yet another person who did not make it with the Aftermath label of Dr. Dre. But like, I would love to hear what his rap sounds like now, because honestly, if he hasn't been recording or writing material, he should have just listened. And this is strong. I would have hoped he would be listening still, which he probably is, you know, because he knows so much about rap. But yeah, all these guys, Young Thug's focus on pitch and melody. Yeah, I would love to know, but that's the thing. Like, I think that's probably the most succinct way to say it. The thing about being ahead of your time is that you've shown people behind you what to do. And so that's, to me, is just the main crux of the issue.
Now, when you actually get a chance to talk to rappers, including some of the rappers you studied, what do you discover? How did they think about what they're doing as opposed to how you think about it? What is that experience like? I know you sat down with Jean Grey, you sat down with Pharaoh, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
What were those conversations like? What did you discover?
They were eye-opening. They were amazing. I learned so much from them. And a lot of what I'm telling you now is directly pulled from those interviews. So it's just like, I mean, Talib Kweli described John Forte as an influence. Then I went and listened to the one, what is it, Family Business rap that he's got on the Fugees, Lauryn Hill. We used to jump rope, but now we gun tote, busting shots off of
Project Rooftop, sending signals with the blunt smoke ock. Don't talk a lot if you can't hold it in lock. If you think lip sync shifts, imagine four Glock clips. I hold the glass of...
And I just heard Talib Kweli. Like, I heard John Forte was rapping, but I heard Talib Kweli. So that's what I'm saying. Like, a lot of what I'm telling you now is just pulled directly from these interviews. So they were eye-opening, but I think it should be mentioned that all rappers think about this stuff differently. Some, I know for a fact that some people are kind of just like, yeah, I'm good at rapping, and they don't really take it past that point, you know? So I don't know if Waka Flocka could tell me why he chose his name as his rapper name, but to me, it's just the perfect rap name, because it lends itself to really musical treatments, because there aren't really any words you could just shout over and over on a rap song and not get clowned for it, you know? But if it's your name, and your name is like a meaningless onomatopoetic sound effect like Waka Flocka, then like, yeah, that's perfect to make an entire
Waka,
song
Waka,
out of.
Waka Flocka, Waka Flocka, Flocka, Waka Flocka, Flocka, Waka Flocka.
Or another thing is like, even Kanye West, you know, he had that tweet where he was like, the second verse on New Slaves is the greatest rap verse of all time.
Throw these Maybach keys, I wear my heart on the sleeve. I know if we the new slaves, I see the blood on the leaves. I see the blood on the leaves. I see the blood on the leaves. I know that we the new slaves, I see the blood on the leaves. They throwing hate at...
I just have so... I don't don't believe that is probably the best way to say it. And so this is my proof that, like, rappers all think about it differently. Because Jean Grey herself, Jean Grey, Tillip Kweli, and Pharoah Monch, Pasta Noose of De La Soul, although I didn't get to ask him quite the questions I wanted to because it was for a website. Jean Grey really thinks about it as music. And I think that comes across not just in her responses, but in her training. I mean, both of her parents were famous jazz musicians from South Africa.
Jean's mother is the late jazz singer and composer Satima B. Benjamin, and her father is pianist and composer Abdullah Ibrahim, formerly known as Dollar Brand.
She could play piano at one point. She used technical musical terminology in our interview, like triplet. So I think she thinks of it definitely as music. Tillip Kweli does too, although, you know, his focus, of course, is always going to be on complex rhymes. But I got this feeling that all rappers think different thoughts, but using the same mind is probably the best way to put it. And you can even see that in, like, their professional relations nowadays. If you follow Tillip Kweli, so many people want him to hold up his title they say that he has as the defender of quote-unquote true hip-hop. They want him to shit on Lil Wayne as being, like, too commercial or whatever, but he just refuses to do it. And I think that's because he sees in Lil Wayne, like, a peer, a colleague, like, someone who's trying to solve the same problems that he is in, like, a musical, artistic way. They speak about it more eloquently than you would ever believe, and that's kind of just why I have put all of this time into writing that book and writing the second book and then doing these lessons and producing music on my own and writing raps on my own and all of this stuff. Those were amazing, though. Those were awesome, eye-opening interviews. It should be noted, though, that I picked these rappers. You know, it's almost like selection bias. Like, I shouldn't say that all rappers think of their raps as musical phenomenon, because I only specifically, purposefully talk to my favorite rappers who are musical rappers. So I would just be careful about kind of like extending those statements beyond that point.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about what else you have going on. When can we expect the book? Tell me about this podcast you're planning on starting. What's going on?
I mean, I'm into so much different shit, because that was always the thing. You know, I use one part of my life to learn about the other part. And so, like, when I come to grad school here at Brandeis and Waltham, I'm in my first year of earning a master's degree. So I'll finish my master's degree next year. Then I hope to go on for a PhD and hopefully teach as a professor at one point, and maybe go to a PhD. Some really great work being done at Indiana and the University of Bristol, where professors Dr. Justin Williams at the latter, Dr. Kyle Adams at the former, are doing all of this work on rap, you know, because as you might imagine, this is not happening at every school. Just trying to make it all fit together, because at this grad school I'm at now, you know, everywhere they split it into composition and musicology. So composition is like you write music, musicology is like you study music. But for me, that splitting up of roles is just like, it's not helpful to me. So I always try to do both and use composition to learn about musicology and use musicology to learn about composition. So I do this in everything, you know. So yeah, like that podcast you do, I think doing a podcast makes me a better writer. So I'm still doing the articles on rap analysis.com. We are getting a new website in the works that will be headed up by Sabrina Dax, the great publicist who did the De La Soul Kickstarter campaign. But the podcast, yeah. And again, it's taken a lot of inspiration from the Cypher, and I know I've talked to your engineer about it before, and he gave me some great ideas and just really got things percolating in my mind about how to think about it, how to structure it, what all these different concerns might be. So that one, yeah, it's a great format. I think it's three songs by the same artist, maybe about 25 minutes long. You listen to each song twice, though, and the first time I talk over it and explain what I listen for.
Take his very opening line, for example, breathing with dragons, I'll crack. Now, the important syllables here are breathe, drag, and crack, because those are the ones Kendrick accents, since he says them louder than the other syllables. But each of those accented syllables actually occurs in threes. It goes breathing with dragons, I'll crack. As a result, breathing,
you know, like, oh, check out this internal rhyme coming up next, and then the song behind me will play. And then the second time one of these three songs get played, I step back and let the listener kind of teach them on their own, because that's always what I've been amazed by when readers reach out to me. I think I'm describing something that people already know, but subconsciously, and don't, like, have the words necessarily to describe it on their own. Like, I just got an email from a guy who was like, there's no way you, like, like, Panda, is there, you know, the designer song? And I was like, actually, dude, I think that song is fucking awesome. So yeah, so there's a podcast in there, a whole bunch of different stuff going on, still teaching lessons, going to school, producing for a great rapper out of Toronto now. He's been billed as New York City's favorite Toronto rapper, this guy Sha, it's real interesting story, but his one song, Payday, is about the gender wage gap.
Y'all been getting like dollars per hour for a minute. Money over bad bitches, money over actresses, money over...
And so that got pretty popular, and he's asked me to do a remix of it.
Money over bad bitches, money over actresses, money over strippers. Pick up paper class with it, money all over the mattress, got money all over the atlas. It's blasphemous. We put money over happiness, so y'all can pray.
Producing some beats for Rone, the King of the Dot, battle rap champion.
While the song with Rone isn't completely finished, Martin sent us some samples of his other production work.
Chase, that was a gobbledy. If that was a yes, Poppy, then we don't want to know what you think, Poppy. Poppy. He thinks it's cool. He thinks it's here.
In the booth, I just dance. I don't fucking rap. Must be the cha-cha. Since when I'm done, we all clap.
So yeah, just always trying to keep it in the mix. And honestly, like, yeah, there are places I want to get to, but I got to be honest, like, all I've ever wanted to do is talk about music like I'm doing right exactly at this moment at 12:56 p.m. on what? Is it the 7th, the 8th? With you. So as long as that's happening and moving forward with stuff like that, all those different projects might be helping out on... at something at Harvard, at the W.E.B. Du Bois Fellowship Center. Yeah, I'm happy as long as all of that stuff is moving forward, though. And especially if it's happening with awesome involved people like you, too, you know?
Awesome. And for one last thing.
Yes.
Can you give us a version of your argument as to why To Pimp a Butterfly is the greatest rap album of all time?
Oh, yeah, that is the, God, yeah, I did write that review, yeah.
Show notes, go check them.
Yeah, no, let me think. No. Oh, yeah, because I did. Yeah, so the thing about that review, right, is that what? The album came out, what, February 15th?
March 15th.
It's 2015, I think. And then, actually, if you notice, the date on that review that you saw was not until June or July. So I really took my time with it and figured, you know, let other people state the obvious that the album is fucking amazing, and then I could maybe do cleanup duty and explain why. So throughout this whole conversation, I've always tried to make an effort to position my work as just one of many. That, yeah, I love musical rappers, and I think the musical existence of rap is my favorite and the most interesting and the most important part of it. But there are all these other perspectives in it. But To Pimp a Butterfly is the best because it does everything. It literally does everything. And I do not listen to the album unless when I put on Wesley's Theory that I know beforehand I have what is it, 82 minutes to listen to the whole thing front to back. Because it's just as unradio single friendly as, I mean, the most extreme stuff of Outkast, dude. You know, like, what single could you possibly pull from Southern Playlist of Cadillac Music? And Kendrick's always been like that after Section 80. Because, I mean, you can even tell Swimming Pools Drank, they cut the final verse, and that completely changes the song from being a party, from being a ironic parody account of the party lifestyle to being a party anthem in itself. So To Pimp a Butterfly, like I said, and all these positions I've tried to position my own work within, it just does everything. You know, if you think of a rapper as being a comedian like Kanye West, a historian like Mos Def, a celebrity like Notorious B.I.G., a storyteller like Tupac, a poet like Eminem, a musician like Jean Grey, To Pimp a Butterfly, Kendrick is the perfect comedian, poet, storyteller, historian, musician, whatever you want to say, you know? And it just, it's so fucking deep that when I'm done listening to it, after I've given it its full 82-minute due, I feel like I've just sat through a grad school class. Like, you just learn so much from the album, and everything seems so thought out that I think the biggest compliment you could pay it is that it seems like Kendrick literally did everything on the album. You know, not since Jay-Z has picked his own producers have we seen a rapper like this better at picking people for him to make beats. And I'm so surprised that, because last time I checked, I don't think Kendrick Lamar gets a production credit on it.
While Kendrick does not have any production credits on the album, he was very involved in the record's overall musical direction. To hear more about the making of To Pimp a Butterfly, check out episode 174 with Robert Glasper and episode 155 with Robert Spud Seawright.
So for the fact that this album just sounds so, God, just so unified. I mean, dude, he had Pharrell making backpack beats.
We gon' be alright, nigga, we gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. We gon' be alright.
But yeah, then you had J. Cole, people like Soundwave, and then the bass player, Thundercat, and just, and him doing the rap, you know? So how do you pull all these people, Glasper doing the piano keys, but it all came out as one. So what do you want from your rap to Pimp a Butterfly gives it to you, you know? Do you want those free-spoken verb fantasies of Gil Scott-Heron, you know, because you have that on for free ? Interlude.
This dick ain't free. You looking at me like it ain't a receipt, like I never made ends meet, eating your leftovers and raw meat. This dick ain't free.
And, like, do you want something hard-hitting, you know, because that's Blacker the Berry.
I'm the biggest hypocrite in 2015. Once I finish this, witnesses will convey just what I mean.
Do you want something socially conscious? Because that's Wesley's theory.
And when you hit the White House, do you? But remember, you ain't passed economics in school. And everything you buy, taxes will deny how Wesley sniped your ass before 35.
Yeah. Do you want something that is musically innovative? I can't remember. I think it's All Right. Yeah, I mean, do you want your socially conscious political struggle anthems? Because that's All Right, like you already see at the different protest rallies and Black Lives Matter rallies movements, comparing it to the songs in the 1960s. That civil rights struggle. So it just does everything. And just for me, for a musician, the chords, the jazz, the harmonies, it is miles beyond the normal square 1-4-5 chords that you get in most pop albums. You know, just those jazz, it's just so, it's deep, man. It's awesome. And I could go on for another hour, but we've already done an hour, so I would prefer not to. But yeah, that is. Yeah. Do you think TPAB is the best ever?
I think that's something time will tell. Yeah, that's
to be decided. Yeah, that's true. I mean, because you could call me out on it and just, oh, another Kendrick dick rider, which, like, yeah, maybe, man. But, like, it's all-encompassing, you know, just in the same way that, like, Ulysses by James Joyce gives you a world, TPAB gives you a world, too. And then it's like the Tupac interview at the end, bringing it all back around.
Sometimes I can, like, get behind a mic and I don't know what type of energy I'm gonna push out or where it comes from. Trip me out sometimes.
Because it's spirits. We ain't even really rapping. We just letting our dead homies tell stories for us.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know. It's strong. It's strong, and I love it. It's deep. There are no dead tracks. I mean, yeah, College Dropout is up there. I think even the life of Pablo is up there too. For what it did for the album as a format, and the leaps Kanye was able to take, even just as rap, as like a collective communal effort. So they're all up there. Then you got the big Tupac ones, obviously. Fuji's The Score, I think I have to put in top three or top two, but To Pimp a Butterfly is up there. It is, I mean, yeah, I don't know. How do you improve on something like Good Kid, Mad City? Kendrick did it, so that might be the best compliment to pay.
Awesome. Well, Martin, thank you so much for your time, man. It was good catching up.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I've been a big fan of Martin's writing since I first discovered it some years ago. It was amazing to me to read someone who took rappers seriously as musicians and broke down what they were doing in terms anyone can understand, even if you don't have a doctorate in composition. I've also seen the way rappers react to what he writes, how amazed and touched artists like Jean Grey and Pharoah Monch are to have their bars analyzed and broken down, and to have the complexity in their work recognized. Join us next week to check out our interview with the noted producer and engineer Skef Anselm. Skef has worked with De La Soul, Brand Nubian, and tons more, including, of course, A Tribe Called Quest.
And oh shit, Skef Anselm, he gets props too.
Even if you haven't heard of him, all of your favorite producers cite Skef as one of their influences. Make sure to listen and find out why. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should listen to our interview with another person who knows a thing or two about piano and composition, Robert Glasper, on episode 174. If you use iTunes, it's incredibly important to give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. Also consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making our show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. In case you didn't know, the bonus material for May is a pre-Son of Berserk version of the track Fresh from the Back of the N41, which was recorded as a promo for Bill Stefney's Mr. Bill show at Adelphi University. It dates from the mid-1980s, it's over 8 minutes long, and it features a pre-Public Enemy Chuck D. Oh, and it doesn't exist anywhere but here, since Bill gave it directly to us. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Like a hipster jackass.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
This inconsistency is consistent.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I thought that I was not a good musician because when I went home, I didn't listen to classical music.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I don't know what that means, to be frank.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Paul Rettle.
He actually pronounces his words really far forward in his mouth.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Okay, yeah. Honestly, yeah, the problem might be me talking too much.